we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. It's been a long road, but we have finally come to the final episode of the classic 1960s series, The Prisoner. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And tonight, we are going to be talking about the final, the classic, the conclusion of this series that has gripped us along the way. And as always, we start out with a summary, but I'm not actually going to summarize it this time. I'm just going to make a couple of basic comments. Since the beginning of The Prisoner, we have followed the exploits of Number 6, a man who finds himself in a community not of his own choosing. Why is he there? Who runs the place? What do they really want from him? Why is it so important? With each twist and turn, the puzzle has become both clearer and murkier. But in this final episode, Fallout, it is simply 50 minutes of the answers being spelled out clearly in black and white for all to see. In a series that's been at times a bit obscure, the finale clubs the viewer over the head with its clarity of vision. In this episode, our hero Number 6 meets Number 1 face to face and defeats him. Or does he join him? Well, I think we've mentioned before, Simon, that you have not seen the series previously and didn't know what was coming, so I'll give you that. What did you think?
Well, it all makes sense now. Everything suddenly is clear.
this is an often talked about episode of The Prisoner for its you know, you either love it or you hate it. Or maybe there's a position in between. I'm not a fan of the episode, I have to say.
You wanted it all to stay unexplained?
I don't know what I wanted from it, but as we've discussed in the past, I think some of the episodes like Free for All, where it's gone a little too far towards the beat you over the head sort of surrealistic worldview, I haven't been as crazy about. And this one really does actually kind of carry that.
I'm not sure I entirely agree. My criticism of Free For All was that some of the allegorical elements within it were, when you say beat you over the head, they were making very, very blunt points, really, I thought. You know, they were using the kind of situation of the village, the furniture within it, to clearly kind of map some aspect of the democratic process that was corrupt or unsatisfactory, and say, hey, look at this, and point a finger and make fun at it. And part of the problem was that there wasn't a coherent ideological underpinning to it. In this, I'm not sure you could say that it's taking any particular aspect, or there's a kind of obvious, direct, allegorical element to any particular part of it, and say what exactly it's mocking or trying to make a point about. Or can you?
I could take a stab at it. You know, and in my quote unquote synopsis, I am being a little bit facetious there in about it, spelling it all out in black and white. I could see how somebody could come away from this. You could come away from this episode going, well, that was very profound. And my guess is that after 36 straight hours of writing, Patrick McGoohan came away from writing this script going, that is really profound, man. But on the other hand, you could come away from this.
You mean he wrote it in one shot?
Yes.
Well, without sleeping.
And then it doesn't say whether he slept or not. But so if he slept, then that's even less than 36 hours. And I think it shows that perhaps it could have used a polish in some ways. But also there were a lot of people who came out of this episode thinking it was incomprehensible gibberish. And in fact, the ATV switchboard was lit up so much that, and I can't 100% prove that this isn't apocryphal, but it is reported in many cases. Patrick McGoohan had to escape the country after this aired. He left the UK.
In case they put him in prison.
In case maybe somebody knew where he lived, because they were getting a lot of irate calls at ATV. They had to issue...
They knew where he lived. The butler would protect him.
There you go. They had to issue a press release explaining the episode. Or giving some explanation, and ATV's explanation is, by the way, quote, the village, quote, symbolized the prison that is man's own mind. Does that sound like a fair assessment of what we watched?
If it is, I would probably say Patrick McGoohan had definitely escaped it. Does that make sense?
I don't know. See what I mean? I do feel like there is some profound ideas that are being thrown around in this episode, but I don't know that the package works. I think we could take that view that really number 48 and number 2 are representing stages in a life again. So kind of carrying on the theme from the last episode, these are the stages of rebellion that man goes through. Youth is always rebellious, although I wasn't really actually quite rebellious. But anyway, and then middle age crisis is what you could take for number 2. You reach a point where you're not satisfied with what life has handed you and carry on. And then, so what's number 6? Self-identity again, that theme, true to yourself.
I don't know, because he's not an old man.
Non-conformity. Stubborn, bloody-mindedness.
Well, yes. There are certainly those themes, but he's not an old man, so in a way.
Well, so the others could be considered conformists. So youth, you live in you're in conformity. The old man, you're in conformity, and you reach. When I say youth is in conformity, I mean childhood. You're in conformity, and you reach youth. That is a break from your prior behavior pattern. Number 2. Conformity, and then the break from the pattern. Number 6, never a conformist. That's why his revolt is true and pure and pristine, or whatever the words were the president used to describe him. And I'm stretching.
Yeah. Number 48, it's a very uncontrolled kind of rebellion. There's no sense of there being any real direction to it. He's running around, he's singing, screaming. Number 2, it was, I mean, as you say, there was a conformity there. It's a kind of last ditch desperation, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
A kind of regret at all the conformity, I suppose, and breaking away at the end. Number 6, the thing that has always stood out, really, and comes from that very controlled performance of McGoohan, is that very deliberate nature, that consistent nature of and thoughtful adherence to what he considers to be, I guess, his principles or his view of the way that he should act as an individual. And that runs against conforming. So in a sense, it is an act of rebellion, but it's not a wild act of rebellion. Does that make sense? It's only huge, it's only big, and it only matters because of its consistency. No particular aspect of it is that much of a threat on its own, but it's just the strength of his dedication and commitment to his own individuality that is the problem, that, you know, because it cannot be overcome, because the village never managed to crush him.
So let's say that number 1, who is, would you, can we, do we agree that number 1 was revealed to be number 6, or did that mean something else? But if
you mean who, what was behind the mask?
Yes.
It didn't look like number 6 to me. Was it number 6?
Yeah. Yeah, it was McGoohan.
It was McGoohan.
Mm-hmm.
Even in that shot through the hatchway closing.
Yes.
Because I freeze-framed that.
They were using a funny lens, I think, to distort that. But yeah.
It really didn't look like his face.
It was supposed to be McGoohan, yeah. I mean, it was McGoohan.
I mean, it felt like it was intended to be, because it felt like there needed to be a big reveal there, but it didn't look like him, and they didn't leave the camera on it. But yeah, okay.
That's the brilliance of Patrick McGoohan's acting, that he can make himself into a wild man and look different, I guess. Maybe we should credit that as good acting. But yeah, it is McGoohan. So, I mean, we are talking about, he is standing trial basically before himself. So he has been...
He's not standing trial.
I kind of get the impression that he's third up. Even though they're talking about inauguration, maybe he's already been convicted. It's hard. Okay, it's really hard to tell.
This is why I was saying the kind of... There isn't an obvious target to the kind of... there are obviously certain symbols and practices and ceremonial things that have been kind of plucked out from our society. So things like the assembly being a little bit like a council or a parliament of some sort. And then you've obviously got a judge in the wig, which comes from the justice system, if you like. Mm-hmm. And you have number six himself, or whatever we must call him now, planted on a throne. Mm-hmm. But it's such a mishmash, that's the thing, because you've got all of these different, there's no way you would bring all of those things together unless that's supposed to represent society itself. It certainly didn't seem to me clear that it was representing a court, because it was only the judge that, you know, would be associated with the court. The other bits would not be anything to do with the justice system.
Okay. I can see that. I can see that. I have always thought that there is the scene where the anarchists get up and read out the charges against number two, non-conforming with society, which of course is a joke unto itself. It's the anarchists that are reading the charges about being against society and conformity and order.
Okay. So I'm kind of trying to keep up with my thoughts here then. But if the choice to bring symbols of different aspects of society together there are significance in some way, is that perhaps because what's going on here is not a trial per se, but it is a judgment in the sense of society's judgment?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
If you like, you won't tolerate, that society won't tolerate anarchy. Because there's all that Hobbesian stuff, isn't there, about needing to have, you know, this is why they need number six, because they need to have some kind of leader. It doesn't matter how good or bad the leader is, but without the state, then life will be nasty, brutish, and short.
Mm-hmm.
So it's rather than it being a trial, it's society's judgments, and the judgments are necessary because they are the judgments that society needs to make on individuals or on individuality or whatever in order to function as a society.
I think yet another facet of the strange conglomeration that is the final episode.
I mean, I'll tell you what I really thought when I finished watching it, which is basically this. It kind of felt to me like they filmed the rap party instead of actually making an episode. It's going, oh, well, you know, it's been a fun series to make. Let's have a bit of a knees up as they're dancing down the motorway and, you know, destroying bits of the set. And, you know, again, it is very theatrical, and they get back certain actors who have appeared in the show quite memorably previously.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a sense, that has a bit of a party feel to it. And they make something that is basically the closest the prisoner gets to doing a musical episode.
Yum, yum.
With all the kind of singing and dance routines. How the hell? They have one of the Beatles numbers.
All You Need Is Love, yeah.
All You Need Is Love, thank you. The Beatles.
I have an answer to this. I know what your question is going to be.
My question is, I watched this on iTunes, right?
Yeah.
And you've got a DVD or a Blu-ray of it? And is it on there?
Yep.
How do they afford the royalties to release that?
I actually have an answer to this. They bought them out completely for that song.
What?
Yep. It's one of the very few Beatles songs in very few theatrical productions that they bought a non-royalty buyout. They can use it without having to pay royalties forever in any medium.
Good God. McGoohan is some kind of wizard or sage. Yeah. What a genius.
He didn't want to use that, I think. There was something about him not wanting to use necessarily that. And the sound man or the music guy said, now this music will be timeless. And so, because he thought it would date the episode by using it. And to be fair, well, the Beatles have lived past the sell-by date of many other bands from that era. And the song, All You Need Is Love, really fits the slaughter with machine guns at the end.
That seemed to me extraordinary as well, that the Beatles allowed that. I mean, we mentioned in a previous episode the fact we were talking about choreographed fight sequences that are accompanied by classical music,
mm-hmm.
because this was done in a previous episode and I couldn't think of anywhere earlier it had been done, but it's been done a number of times since, and so it's a kind of curiosity of is this when the ground was broken. The machine gun fight with All You Need Is Love over it, that was shocking. I've never seen anything like that. and It really did surprise me that the song was allowed to be used in that way. But, you know, in terms of the dissonance that created, it's a fantastic sequence.
You have to wonder if John Lennon would have seen it that way. And in a way, I kind of think he might. I actually kind of think he might see the dissonance there as being a meaningful expression and not degrading the song.
Yes. Yes, true.
Paul McCartney, I don't know. But John Lennon was a lot more cynical, I guess, maybe, would be my take on it. You know, there's sort of the positive and the negative personalities there, and John Lennon seemed a lot more grounded in reality. So
yes, and I guess the Beatles did dabble a little in surrealism themselves.
So ooh, yeah.
They might have been sympathetic to the project from that perspective.
They dabbled in surrealism in their real lives, chemically, I think. So because it just really isn't. I mean, there really isn't a story there to me. So I'll ask questions. Was it a trap? In other words, was this another village plot that they were executing against him up until the point where he got the machine guns and started cutting people down?
Well, actually, aren't there two questions there? Because one question is that question with up to the point as the rider that you added. The other question is, was it a trap, full stop? Has he left the prison?
The door says he hasn't.
The door?
Yeah. The butler's, when they get to the house and the door opens and it's got
So, which suggests that the whole thing is a trap. Or possibly just that because people from the village refurbished his house, they used a little bit of their village door-shutting technology in the refurbishment.
That would be nice of them.
It would be nice of them, but then, you know, they didn't have to clean his windows and all that, so whatever.
Well, it makes it easier for the cameras to see through them.
Yeah, true. I mean, it could have been a trap. Obviously, it could have been a trap because these stories thrive on that kind of ambiguity. But it's not clear to me how the trap would have worked, unless it was straight that they wanted him to be their leader, as they said. In other words, it was not so much them being duplicitous as them saying exactly what they meant.
What about the orbit chambers in the rocket? Orbits 48 and Orbit 2 they had.
Well, I don't know what so the whole rocket thing. I mean, I don't know the answer to this. In a way, any question you ask, this is the thing. The prisoner has been chugging through 16 previous episodes, raising questions, and so episode 17 has the baggage with it of expecting to deliver some answers. So you can go through your questions and you can ask your questions. But it doesn't seem to me that this episode actually answers anything at all, except in giving you lots of possible answers, because maybe he does escape, right?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
doesn't have to cross the water or anything.
There are new questions associated with that there, but maybe the escape is as it appears to be. Maybe, as we've just alluded to, it is all of it another trap, and so that he will believe he's left the village when he hasn't left the village, and in that way he will completely remain a prisoner because he will no longer have any concept of escaping. There are the other questions that we've had through the series about what was the village for. Was it set up by the British Secret Service in order for agents who were too valuable to let loose could be kind of farmed, as it were, in a sort of almost happy retirement? Or was it run by the opposition in order to park agents who they needed to extract information from? Or, and this has come up a few times, was it this New World concept, which is where this rocket comes in? I mean, presumably that's the idea with the rocket. That's the question that's not being answered there.
Oh, it's kind like of an Exodus.
A Moonraker-style thing, where, yeah, they're going to go off and colonize somewhere. Because what else? Why is there a rocket there?
I don't know. I have no idea why there's a rocket there.
It's kind of cool, but where's it going?
Well, I think on orbit 48, it's going to eject the kid, and on orbit 2, it's going to kick out to number 2. And I don't know and you notice there was another one there, the orbit with no number, and they opened that as the prisoner went by, like that was for him. So, is that to protect him and take him on the ship, or was that for eventual disposal purposes, which make no sense whatsoever, because it's kind of expensive to dispose of people by sending them up in a rocket. But I don't know. Can we get
but
something?
What would they
from,
have been orbiting?
Can we get something? But who knows? I mean, the rocket itself was an ICBM, so I think that was a ICBM? British Blue Streak, intercontinental ballistic missile. When they actually show it taking off, that's actually a weapons rocket. But British, when you guys were trying to get into the world destruction game like we are,
that wasn't me, just to be clear. But
y'all, it's sort of the royal. You're part of that society, conformity and all that stuff. So
this is my burden.
So do we learn anything from what happens to them after the three people leave the village? Number 2 goes back to his old life? So his rebellion is over?
One of the things you alluded to was he doesn't have to cross the water.
Yeah.
Now, that's interesting because in Many Happy Returns, doesn't he, I can't remember the exact geography of it, but doesn't he search for the village within a certain radius of somewhere around Gibraltar or something?
Yeah,
like
I think
that?
So.
It's, you know, Mediterranean. North Africa, kind of. To drive from there to London without crossing the water is interesting. Also, in Many Happy Returns, he left on a raft because it turned out the village was surrounded by mountains, which presumably have gone if he can now drive a lorry straight out of the village.
Tunnel?
Maybe that
was the tunnel they were driving through at the...
Yeah, but that looked like it came out in the village still. But yeah, I guess, okay, that's a possible explanation. But then they come out and they're driving on the left. Now, I can't remember. I've never been to Gibraltar. It's a bit of a crazy place, so maybe they do drive on the left there. But it just did kind of look like,
Britain.
Put all that together, it looked like he kind of came out in Wales or England.
Maybe wherever you go, there you are. That's the kind of profundity of that.
Yeah, or you know, it felt like he was driving off the lot, off the film set, and... the rap party continues.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So the Dembones singing seemed to cause great consternation in society. Is that religion? Does religion upset the structure, or is it the power of music? What was with the jukeboxes? Were the jukeboxes telling us something about the power of music to pacify the masses? I feel like there's something there too, but I can't get a grasp on it. That's how I feel about the show. I feel like they put something in front of me and like, here you go. I just can't pluck it out. And to me, ultimately, either I'm stupid or it's a failure on the writer's part, and I'm going to go with failure on the writer's part just because. Better people than I have tried to figure out The Prisoner, and I don't think they've succeeded either. So I don't know.
I'm not sure. The music as a revolutionary act seemed to be part of it to me. Though, obviously, that does raise questions about their security, because the guy starts having a bit of a sing-song and suddenly everyone's in chaos and they can't control him. So, but yeah, I don't know how that links with the jukeboxes, so...
Or if it links with the jukeboxes, I don't know. So the people who were up in the gallery, I just made a note of every one of them I could find, every section.
Oh, okay.
There was good welfare, track. Activists, pacifists, identification, defectors, information, education.
What do I want? Information.
Therapy, reactionists, nationalists, youngsters, recreation, entertainment, and anarchists. And there were others that I couldn't get, placards that I couldn't see, but I tried my best to get all of them off the list. Facets of the society, facets of, but some of them like therapy, are they methods of?
I took them, as sort of in show or in world explanation, being that they were departments in effect. They were, because it was a sort of council or assembly, that they were representatives of each of those departments, though you'd have to assume that a department called pacifists or anarchists was a department that was actually about looking after or controlling those people. So I don't know whether it stands up. I didn't read your full list. I saw a couple of them.
Mm-hmm.
Identity, that was one that stuck out, or identification. But yes, I mean, in a sense, it would make more sense what you say, that they are kind of representatives of sectors of society rather than something more functional than that.
Let's see. So now, number 48, he's going crazy. He's singing the song. They're dancing around.
I forget whether that was his number in Living in Harmony.
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember. Guess we should look that up.
Because that's his hat from Living in Harmony, isn't it?
I think so. But it's not his outfit. Oh, by the way, outfit. Okay. That is the outfit I was talking about when, on one of our previous Doctor Who episodes, I said that when I look at a early 1970s, late 1960s British show, and you get something like John Pertwee's costume, I actually reasonably believe that somebody in Britain could go down to a store and buy that in that time period because of this stereotype. That is the British, I don't even know what classification of 60s counterculture style, but that shows up in, I don't know, I'm sure there must be one in Dracula 80, 72 when they got the kids and just, it's not a look that we ever had here to my knowledge, but you see it in British shows. And so I look at that and I go, yeah, I mean, it's weird. It's feels out of time, but obviously there were stores that sold them somewhere. So I can believe that Pertwee could pull that out of somebody's locker and go, whoa, look at that. I found this outfit. But, that's just an aside I throw out. But anyway, number 48 is out of control until number 6. I probably shouldn't call him number 6, but I'm not going to call him sir. until number six calls him young man. Term of respect? Is that what we're supposed to get out of it? It's like, you just need to give these people a little respect.
Doesn't seem a very respectful term to me, but...
Compared to 48?
Maybe. It's still a label.
Well, so is sir. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, everything's a label. I don't know. It seems like that was what they were getting at, but I don't know. So let's look at number two a little bit. We already mentioned that he was obviously a man of influence who came over to the ways. But what is revealed here is that he too was abducted and taken to the village. And he cracked, unlike number six. So not a place for spies, necessarily. People are brought here because they could be useful.
Why are you saying not for spies? You think he wasn't a spy?
No, I didn't think he was a spy. I thought he was like a political power broker.
Because he gets taken back to
Parliament. Westminster. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well,
yeah,
and the way he said it, too, you know, whisper in an ear here, you know, that sounds like, can't think of his name. You know, the guy in the thick of it.
Malcolm Tucker,
yeah. He seems like one of those. Maybe not quite as foul mouthed, but you know, somebody who's got power but isn't visibly the power. He's also made over as a new man in this
episode. Oh yes. Now there are a couple of interesting things about that. One of which was it's the first time I've ever seen a Dalek shave someone. And man, that must be a big Dalek because the size of that plunger. The other question I had was I didn't have on your suggestion I waited until the last minute to watch this, so I would be fresh to make this recording with my recent impressions. I haven't had time to look up whether this was the last episode produced.
Yes.
And whether the previous episode was the penultimate episode produced.
No. No. They were months apart.
Right. Because Leo McKern looks really different. I mean, obviously, he's been shorn a bit, but his hair looks a different colour as well.
I think...
So was all that to avoid a continuity problem?
Yep. It was entirely to avoid the continuity problem. He had shaven and for some play he was in, or some production... had the different hairstyle, and they just had to work around it. If you'll note, when they're hauling the body out, that clearly isn't McKern. They're obscuring it as they carry him. The only angles you ever get are not him until the moment when they have the shaving cream all over his face. That's the first time you actually see his face in this episode. Right. So it's a clever bit of filming. I hadn't really thought about it until I knew he was renewed as a different looking guy in this episode. So I was watching a little more carefully when I went through it this time. But, yeah, that was just a continuity thing. They had shot I can't think of its name. Once Upon a Time, sixth episode took quite some ways back. Quite some ways back.
The other thing that occurred to me in terms of, timing, was, the whole James Bond lair feel to it. Did you get that?
Mm-hmm.
That has plagued James Bond films from You Only Live Twice onwards, pretty much. This whole concept of having an underground lair, i.e. studio, full of men in multicoloured boiler suits running around with guns. So I think You Only Live Twice was 67.
Yes.
Would it have been released before this was filmed or not? Presumably it can't have been. It's just a coincidence, or maybe they both have a common inspiration.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to believe that the helmeted sort of look for the guards wasn't taken from a Bond film. And we didn't have that beforehand? We didn't have helmeted guards before You Only Live Twice? Thunderball?
Well, no? Thunderball, they're all wearing different coloured wetsuits, so in a way that does the same kind of thing. But you don't have the same underground lair thing, which, you know, seemed to become a bit of a thing.
It's redress of the girl who was Death Sets.
Ah.
That was the episode that was shot immediately prior to this.
Right.
And in fact, when they started filming it, that's when McGoohan told the crew this was the last episode, too. They didn't bother to tell him up to that point.
What, you mean? But they'd already, they knew it was the 17th episode, so they wouldn't have known it was
the
going,
last
going
episode.
To finish the series. They thought there would have been more than 17 episodes.
Apparently so.
That must have been an interesting one. I think that probably must have cast a pall on the actual rap party. Probably much less jolly than what we saw. Maybe my imagining is not totally justified.
You have to think that there's probably a group of people who got on really well with McGoohan that probably had a rap party. And then there was probably a group of people who hated that man's guts and wouldn't have anything to do with him. Just based on what we've learned throughout the course of the series. There's an anecdote that the sequence where he jumps over the rail with the fire extinguisher and jumps into the robed men, he wanted it done a certain way. His stuntmen said, "You don't want to do it that way." And McGoohan, being McGoohan, said, "No, I want it done that way." So the stuntmen did it, and the stuntman was hurt, and the three people he jumped into were hurt. And there were some hard feelings there. But apparently afterwards that day, McGoohan had the pub and a bottle of whiskey each for the guys. He got made amends. So he liked to get his way. And there were apparently from time to time people who were not happy with him. So I think it's reasonable to assume that probably he was a polarizing figure.
Yeah, certainly sounds like.
So what about his encounter with Number One?
Well, yes. Number one, the way Number One was set up, with the eye and the fact we were supposed to believe that Number Two, or the old Number Two, never actually met him. Because the judge appeared to be able to communicate with him.
Yeah.
In much the same way Harry Corbett used to communicate with Sooty, or was it Sweep?
Not an illusion I'm familiar with.
Yeah, you didn't get that? You know, the puppets, and they would whisper in his ear, and he would say, "You did what, Sooty?" or whatever. So you'd hear one side of the conversation. And it struck me as it had that kind of children's program vibe of this sort of mm-hmm. model with an eye squeaking out messages that the judge was listening to and saying, "Oh, really? Oh, well, all right then," or whatever. So we kind of hear that one side of the conversation. We have to infer everything else from it. That seemed to me not the strongest aspect of the episode. And as I say, when we actually see Number One and his mask is pulled off. Both his masks, indeed. I didn't quite get that was actually McGoohan there because it was too brief. Yeah, I don't quite know what to make of that.
Are we pulling aside the mask is civilization and underneath it we're an animal and you pull that back and reveal that we're looking at ourselves? I don't know. I'm sure that this has been wrestled with for a while. I have perhaps some answer on it for later on, but I wanted to exhaust all our discussion before I pull up about the only thing Patrick McGoohan's ever said about this, and I have it. Well, I'll read the quote back later on what he had to say about the episode. But
you can probably consider me exhausted. I don't have any searing insight onto what exactly that might mean. There doesn't seem to be any in-world explanation. It seems to me one of the aspects of the show that has to be purely symbolic. I suppose it ties in with the prisoner of his own mind notion. But
there are a couple of lines that were cut, and I'll put them out. One of which was when Number Two spits in the eye. There's a line cut out where he says before that, and it kind of makes sense that it's in what it should have been in there. He says, Number One doesn't like it. He gets annoyed when you study him. And working on the idea that it's yourself, sometimes self-reflection is uncomfortable mm-hmm. in people. So I can kind of see how that line leads to, in keeping with, it really is himself. I mean, it obviously surrealistically weird, but number one really is ultimately the person that keeps us in prison is ourselves. And I'll go with that. Let's see, do I have anything else? We had a couple other things that were cut out. You may have noticed the scene where all the people on the mopeds in the scuba gear were escaping from the lair. Mm-hmm. They had had a scene earlier at the beginning of the episode that got cut where when the supervisor was taking McGoohan and the butler into the chamber, there was a place between the jukeboxes and the entry to the chamber where there was a red, yellow, and green light with go, slow, and stop written on it. And there was some, and I read the script section two times and I still can't figure out what they were going for, but it involved when the light was on go, then there was a steady stream of traffic of these people going, and then it would go slow and you could go, but then it would, when they hit stop, then they would all drive around madly in circles and things. And McGoohan had to get through that to get to the chamber. And for some reason, they're supposed to be in scuba gear on mopeds and things. It wasn't very clear on paper either, but they did end up being shown later on because they had already shot this stuff. And everybody loves a good moped-riding scuba diver in your cave, I suppose. Okay, well, then let's turn to McGoohan himself. Looking in the prisoner original scripts book by Robert Faircloth, or edited by Robert Faircloth, Volume 2, which I previously mentioned is goes for thousands on Amazon, and I do have a beautiful matching set in almost perfect condition, and I will sell for $5,000 for the pair. Just get in contact with me at this point. I love these books. I really do. They have like a couple of scripts that weren't made, and I said I love them, but for $5,000, I would see the back of them. And we will convert. Yeah, if you want to pay in pounds sterling or whatever, euros, I'll take it. It's fine. In the book, in discussing this final episode, they mention an interview that McGoohan did in 1979, and he talked about the Freudian psychological theories and awareness and all those things, but he wanted to point out with the that basically you're trapped in a circle, and what happens when you, how to get out of that circle, and here's what he had to say. He starts shooting guns. This was always part of the original conception. I'd been aiming for it since the beginning. In fact, around the world today, we have constant strifes, and sometimes, in the course of history, you will find in a buildup of these frustrations, it comes to a conflict area where a war can clear the air. This constantly happens throughout history. If you go back to the beginning of time, Greece, Rome, Napoleon, the First World War, the Second World War, and eventually the Third World War, there is a conflict building up now worldwide. Israel, Egypt, Dublin, Ireland, England. Idi Amin, it's building up like a volcano about to erupt. I am not a pessimist. I prefer to be a realistic optimist, hoping that it won't happen, but in every instance, there has to be a breaking point. That's the reason I used violence. Even though we hadn't done that sort of thing before, suddenly he's shooting everyone in sight with machine guns, after which they leave the place, and you've got these three guys dancing a jig and singing a song, the hip bones connected to the thigh bone, which, in a way, was a celebration of freedom after violence. Then he goes back to his little house. It should never have finished with the two words, the end. It should have finished with the two words, the beginning. Because no one is a free man. No man is an island. The whole point of the prisoner, which the last episode made clear, is that each man is a prisoner unto himself. Number one, who some people thought was going to be some James Bond character with a bald head and gold teeth or whatever, was actually man's biggest enemy, himself. And that is what one is constantly fighting each day. The biggest enemy we have is ourselves. That's the prisoner. Is that what you would have taken out of this?
It's not necessarily what would immediately have occurred to me. If they held that shot on number one a moment longer, so I had actually been, rather than suspecting it was the man himself, I had actually been certain of it, that might have coloured my impressions of it. I guess it makes some sort of sense.
I guess it does.
I mean, the village is a construction. It represents society only then in so much as it represents his own perception of society. But that would be enough of a constriction, I suppose.
I the one thing I do completely agree with in McGowan there is the part about the guns. I mean, there have been the occasional gun in the prisoner over the years, but by and large, they're not used in the context of the village. Like, we're going to have a gun in Chimes of Big Ben, I think. Somebody's shooting at them. But on the outside world, we did see one with the schizoid man, but I think it was a special gun, wasn't it? Not a killing gun, but a trank gun or something like that. But by and large, the imposition of order was done through societal pressures, technological pressures, Rover as the threat, but not through what is kind of the norm of the world in a way, is that it's held in check by arms.
Yeah.
To some degree.
It's interesting because I tweeted a link. A librarian friend of mine mentioned a project where they were using iPads and what were described as rovers, which obviously actually meant librarians, but immediately made me think of the prisoner. So I tweeted her a link to a little YouTube clip of Rover from The Arrival with that kind of screeching sound. And her response was quite interesting because she said, I don't want to watch that. I can cope with gory stuff, but I don't like psychological violence. So, I mean, I take the point. Guns aren't used in the village in the way that they are used in Fallout, in the sense of blazing away and, you know, sort of indiscriminate shooting and death. But there is a real sense of violence underlying everything. And sometimes there are violent deaths caused by Rover, but in a very, very controlled way. And I think maybe what McGowan is alluding to there is something to do with the kind of the way in which violence breaks out of a very pressurized or a tinderbox situation, whether that's, you know, the violence he was expecting right in 1979. It doesn't mention it, but there's obviously the Cold War at that point, and that is perhaps the bigger
we mentioned World War III.
Ireland, really. I mean, maybe that's where World War III would arise from. Or, you know, World War One.
In 1979, that's
situation in Europe.
Yeah, in 1979, that's World War III was always in the public mindset. That was the Cold War.
That would have been the Cold War. Yeah, okay. But you know, what the Cold War actually represents is a much. It's not that the war isn't violent. It's very violent in its way, but it's controlled and kept in check by the balance of power being maintained. When the balance of power starts to shift, the risk is the violence spirals out of control. And that's, I guess, kind of part of the whole Hobbesian justification for having a ruler that, you know, was being set up by the judge in this episode.
I think the pressure cooker notion, I think that's what we're, I think that's, I see that. I didn't see it at the time. I didn't see it until I read that quote. And I go, yeah, I can see this tipping point that we have as a species had time and time and time again, where people will continue under whatever form of societal oppression. You know, you could take so much, but at some point the cycle is only broken by people getting, it's very negative attitude in the world, but it has often been the case.
But look at, this is making more and more sense the more I think about it. If you consider the way in which McGowan has portrayed the man throughout, you know, the previous 16 episodes of The Prisoner, it's all been about absolute control, very, very kind of the most you'd ever get would be the tiniest glimpse of the rage, the aggression boiling underneath. He would never let it get out of his grip. It would always be about control. But whenever he talked about the village, his goal was the total destruction of it, the kind of anger and resentment and hate that he felt for the village and that whole organization always seemed to be the overriding emotion, particularly when he ever seemed to have left the place. So, you know, what maybe in some way what's satisfying about this episode is that you do get a complete destruction of the village, and in the process, or in order for that to happen, number six does basically completely lose control because he is, you know, randomly firing machine guns at all of these bystanders, essentially. Yes, part of the village structure, the village society that has imprisoned him, but nevertheless all individuals in their own way. And he has that moment of completely losing control. And then, as he alludes to afterwards, the euphoria of freedom. How did he put it in the quote you read?
He said there was a celebration of freedom after violence.
Okay. So that celebration takes the expression of, again, a form of... Not quite loss, but loosening of that self-control. I mean, if we think about, there was certainly an episode where there was a ball and we discussed
Dance
the fact
the
that
dead.
He refused to dance of the dead. There you go. It's in the title. He refused to dance. And yet here he is happily linking arms with, number two or whatever we should call him now. And, you know, dancing away in a very wild and abandoned manner. So there is something there in the kind of the control is gone, and there is this huge act of destruction. The symbolism of this seems to me to be inescapable, and when I listen to this back on the podcast I'm going to regret it. But there is also another act here that has to do with loss of control,
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't say quite dancing a jig afterwards, but the fact that there's a rocket fired in the middle of it.
I see what you're going for. We have mentioned Freudian, yeah. So
having thought of it now, this is the problem with The Prisoner, isn't it? I can't escape drawing the evidence together around that conclusion.
Well, now you know why the rocket was in there.
Yes, that does make some more sense to me now.
A symbol of power and going off, and I am gonna look that one up after this.
I hope it's not just
podcast
me.
and see if anyone else has ever come up with the theory of phallic symbolism in the final episode of The Prisoner. So the fallout is actually post-coital.
Well, I don't know. It's been 47 years or whatever. Someone must have done in that time.
I'm sure. I'm absolutely sure somebody has come up with that before. Any thoughts, takeaway you want to give on the series as a whole, having now completed the journey?
I did wonder, before I started watching, anyone who follows me on Twitter will have noticed that I did ask myself whether this would change my perception of the show, partly because I wondered whether we would get certain answers, and I did wonder, you know, through every discussion that we've had previously, when I was kind of blundering around going, maybe this means that, maybe this means that, whether you were sort of sniggering behind your hand because you knew all the way through who number one was. Or
okay, I want you to make sure that when you listen to the podcast for Once Upon a Time, I know I threw at least two things in the conversation that were alluding to this episode in casual, and I was having a snicker about it at the time.
So, that doesn't surprise me. But having said that, there were not there were not these kind of big, clearly drawn answers to it. The other kind of risk with final episodes is that they can be so they can feed you things or give you ideas about the show that are just so disappointing, I suppose, that they colour all the previous episodes.
Again, Life on Mars, yeah.
Good example.
Or Ashes to Ashes, one of the both. But anyway.
Well, I think Life on Mars in particular for me, because I really didn't like the ending to that. But that's the idea. You get an ending to a show where, you know, it's and the whole premise of the show in Life on Mars, you know, is he dead, is he mad, or is he back in time? And you get an answer. And so whenever the question is asked when you rewatch the episodes, which frankly I haven't bothered to do, you know the answer to that question. So it's kind of like, so what? So there was a risk of that. I think even if you didn't like this episode, and it sounded like you weren't a big fan of it,
it wouldn't have
spoiled the rest of the show for you. Or it wouldn't have coloured your view of the rest of the show.
It has absolutely colored the view of the show over
really?
The years. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I noticed it when I was watching the episode when we were discussing it. And, you know, watching the episodes along, and as we would go in to discuss it, there were times when I would allude to this conformity of society over and over again. And you would occasionally make a comment that you hadn't gotten that out of the episode. And looking at it, trying to break it apart, go, you know, maybe not. I think it is this last episode. Knowing where it was going, I had this feeling that he was, be true to yourself. Be those concepts come back in episodes. I do see it in them. I don't know if it was there the first time through. But I think
okay,
I am getting colored.
I mean, obviously, there would have to be, on some level, even if it's totally subconscious, some influence over your interpretation of the episodes. But has it changed your level of enjoyment?
No.
Of the rest of the show?
No. I enjoy the other episodes for what they are. They are mostly nicely standalone. You know, the few that I don't really like Dance of the Dead or Free for All or Fallout, for that matter, are the exceptions to the rule.
Okay.
The game that we play through the episode wins for me, as opposed to the overall goal.
Yes. But obviously Fallout is significant because of its status as the kind of the end, as it were, the answer, or the space where the answer should be.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, my view of the episode is I like it. I really enjoyed it, partly because, you know, watching it with this concept that they'd filmed the rap party, that it's they're very charismatic actors. The music it gives it an energy. It's a real sort of high energy episode. It does leave up to this kind of, and you know what I'm thinking now, but climactic finale. Of, you know, everything, going off. yeah, I can't resist it. But, you know, and this kind of, that whole thing feels very satisfying. As they're all sort of driving down the motorway and celebrating and everyone's going home and everyone's happy. And then you just get this little hint. With the door closing, but overall the kind of tone and feeling of the episode is quite celebratory. So it's a kind of high energy episode with a lot of celebration in it. And the only quibble would be, well, it doesn't make much sense. And I guess the question is, how important is that? Because to me, I still enjoy the episode. Even though you can ask me a load of questions, what does this mean, what does that mean, and I will have to answer, quite honestly. Not quite sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think that for a show that is all about questions, which it has been, you run the risk of being less than satisfying if you don't answer them. I mean, it's not just like every question has to be answered. I'm not going to go so far as to say that, but when the questions are very, very germane to the plot and you don't get them at the end or you don't get ones that make sense, I can understand why they had a lot of calls, angry calls to the ATV. I wouldn't have called, but the first time I watched the episode, I just kind of sat there and like,
you would,
what
you
the heck
called.
Did I just
You've
got watch?
You've got to remember there's no Twitter in 1967.
Yeah. What
did
I just watch?
Outlet.
And it's not the most successful end episode, but at the same time, you're right. It does end on a high note. They are celebrating. It isn't a downer like Life on Mars. And it ends, but it really feels like a bit of a cop out. I mean, even to the point where they can just drive off to England. It's like, you know, we're just taking shortcuts here to get to the end of the story now. And then the story itself, the pieces as we watch it individually are just kind of loosely strung together. And so it doesn't command my attention like a better structured narrative story would. So, I mean, those are the reasons I'm not crazy about Fallout, really. But it does end the series. And it does leave you at least on a positive note that even if he is still a prisoner, at least he's a happy prisoner now in a bigger prison. So as a whole on the series, does it deserve its status as the cult series that it is purported to be?
Yes. No question, really. No question. Not every episode is an absolute classic. And obviously it's only 17 episodes long. It's quite short, but so inventive and really, yeah. I mean, I can see myself rewatching those episodes and asking new questions of each one and getting something new every time. And that kind of central performance by McGoohan, obviously there's some great guest performances in there, but McGoohan is so central to this and he's so terrific in it. You know, as an actor, obviously he played a big role behind the scenes as well, but as an actor, it's really a wonderful performance. The whole thing, it looks great. Yeah. The locations and the fact that I suppose that was a slight disappointment in this. There wasn't enough, Port Merion in it, but obviously we did get a bit, and that was nice. But yeah, I mean that I mentioned that because it obviously is part of what people remember about the show, and I can see why. It's incredibly distinctive. So yeah, no, definitely a classic.
So now you have to watch the remake with Ian McKellen.
But do I?
Yeah, I've never watched it. Nope.
You haven't?
No, I refuse.
So it might be brilliant.
It might be, but I'd say the odds are probably statistically well stacked against it.
Yeah.
I don't think I heard anything good about it after it aired, but I think it failed to capture the prisoner. Ha, ha. Anyway.
But you know, what I did discover, because, you know, we've been saying this is the end, what I did discover, and I didn't know until this week, was that Patrick McGoohan returned to the role of number six. Did you know this?
No.
Season 12 of The Simpsons.
Oh, okay. I think I did.
I haven't seen it, but I think I'm going to have to watch it now because obviously this viewing isn't complete.
Season 6 of The Simpsons. Well, I'll have to track
season,
that down.
Season 12. Did 12. I say 6?
I don't know. 12. Six, 12. 6 of one, half dozen of the other. What do you want?
I know what you're doing there. No, that would have been nice, wouldn't it? But yeah, no.
Well, season 12 is 2 sixes. Maybe they can. Well, they're not going to get him back for season 36. All right. Well, thank you for joining me on this journey through the village.
Well, it's been a pleasure. I'm only sorry there won't be a next time.
And I'm sure we'll come up with something else to gab on about.
Well, I look forward to that. As long as it's not Man from Atlantis.
And listeners, I hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.